is called to order. It's 1:20.
He may.
And it's the 18th of April. Present for the record are Representatives Gruenberg, Anderson, Guerra, Coghill, and myself, McGuire. We do have a quorum to conduct business. We have, first up, we're going to take up the recommendation for appointment of the Attorney General. Then we'll go to the confirmation hearing for the Board of Governors at the Alaska Bar. Mr. Joseph Fallhaber, who's on the phone. Then we're going to go to House Bill number 257, then House Bill number 133, and House Bill number 92. House Bill 177 we will not take up today at the request of the sponsor. So, without further ado, we represent Coghill.
Madam Chair, since we had the Attorney General confirmation hearing in joint judiciary the other day, I would move that we send recommendation to the full body for Attorney General Dave Marquez. And I know that ours is not necessarily approval or disapproval, but it's to recommend that we heard him. And I don't know even if on the sign-up sheet we have, or the signature sheet, that we actually put our recommendation, other than that we've heard him and are recommending him to the full body.
Thank you, Representative Coghill. Yeah, and in point of fact, Vanessa will submit this around, but we specifically put on there that this does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against any individual during any further session. So, okay, so the motion is there. Is there an objection to the motion? To forward that name on to the full body? Okay, hearing none, the name of Mr. David Marquez will be forwarded on to the full body. For consideration of his appointment to the state of Alaska as the Attorney General. And I will sign this and then send this around to members. Okay, next we have got Mr. Fallhaber is online. Are you there, Mr. Fallhaber? Fallhaber. Can you hear us?
Well, Madam Chair.
Is he online? Maybe if you undo your mute button. There you go. Okay. Are you there, Mr. Fallhaber? We can't hear you at all. I don't know if you're talking. Let's take a brief Eddie's. On record, Mr. Joseph Fallhaber, are you on the line? This is the House Judiciary Committee. Okay. Well, hopefully you can hear us. We cannot hear you for whatever the reasons are. Maybe it's a cell connection or the mute button or something. I'm not sure, but we'll go ahead and set your name to the side and anxiously await your voice. We will have Judiciary Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday. So those are your other opportunities if you still want to be on the Board of Governors of the Alaska Bar. Okay, so that brings us to House Bill number 257. And we had to adjourn. We were in the midst of public testimony. And Mr. Barry Jackson was in the middle of his testimony. Okay, we're taking an Eddie's. No one's hearing anything. I'll try one more time, actually. I'll go back to Mr. Fallhaber to see if he's there. Mr. Joseph Fallhaber, can you hear us at all?
Yes.
Okay, fantastic. So we'll set the House bill to the side and come back to the appointment for the Board of Governors of the Alaska Bar. So tell us why you want to continue your service on the Board of Governors for the Alaska Bar.
Well, selfishly, I enjoy it. I've met some bright people that I enjoy working with, but probably more what you're after is I think that a person with my background brings a different perspective to the Board of Governors, oftentimes more of a pragmatic view rather than just a legal view. And this extends not only to the operating of the Bar Association, but also in matters involving creativity and even so much as in discipline occasionally. And I can be more specific in that. One of the things that one small victory I accomplished is in my past service, I single-handedly introduced and sold the fact that the bar ought to accept credit cards. There's a lot of resistance to it, and now that it's been in place for a number of years, virtually everyone is pretty happy with it, you know, from the lawyers to the administrators.
Madam Chair?
Representative Gruenberg.
Fullhaber, were you talking about for lawyers to be able? I assume you're talking about lawyers accepting credit cards, not the Bar Association.
Well, the Bar Association, and one of the unforeseen benefits of that was oftentimes in the past, attorneys would be late with their dues, and they would be suspended from practice until they hand-carried a check over. Now with the credit cards, most of the time, almost always, a phone call from the administration of the bar to the attorney, get a credit card number and an okay, and we're good to go.
Well, that's a great idea. May I dialogue? Two things, and I think I may have brought one of these up to you when you were up for your confirmation hearing last time. I think it's time that the bar had mandatory continuing legal education like every other profession on the face of the earth. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I might have told you last time, but there was a gang of four or five of us, that I use that term facetiously, but we actually, as you know, we actually passed mandatory legal continuing education, and the Supreme Court turned it down.
Yes, I'm certainly aware of that, and I have made my own views known as just one legislator that I am seriously considering introducing legislation on the subject. I hope that the Supreme Court follows your recommendation. The staff gave me a copy of your recommendation. I haven't read that, but I'm sure it was an excellent piece of work. That's number one. Number two, I think it's also time that the bar allowed legal specialization like they do in some states by examination and get high-quality standards for various areas. I'm a member of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers, and I know in a number of states they have, like California has, legal specialization certified. And do you have any thoughts on that, sir?
I would be in favor of it. Another thing that I did, again,
thank you,
candidly, was got a statement for the bar. And in that mission statement, to advance the science of jurisprudence, if the bar is going to benefit from occupational licensing, there should be, I think that the public should be able to expect a standard. And there's, of course, resistance from that always, but people are pretty reasonable once you make your case, and I would be in favor of what you're talking about.
Well, thank you. I hope you continue your good work, and even if you had opposed it, it's perfectly okay. But thank you for listening to one member of the bar anyway. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, and I just want to say thank you, too. I think one of the things that's very important is to have public members on the Board of Governors to the Alaska Bar Association to offer a different perspective, because it's very unusual the way that we regulate lawyers. It's the only profession that really self-regulates, and there are a lot of opinions about whether or not that's effective or not. That being said, I think at a minimum you do need that public presence to oversee some of these things, and I suspect you're able to provide a real different perspective. The only other thought I had while we're on that subject, we've actually in this committee had Board of Governor appointees in our committee for a couple hours with various questions we've had, but today we've got a full agenda. But there was something that Representative Guerra had brought up a while ago to the bar, and we continue to ask members like yourself when they're before us to consider these things and want to know if you've made any progress. The first is whether or not you have continued discussions on creating a separate bar fee, if you will, a lower fee for those individuals who choose to work in the nonprofit arena or to serve, for example, in the legislature and not actively practice in a firm. That's one. And then the other thing is there was a very thorough discussion in this committee the last time we had an appointee up over the extremely high rates that lawyers pay, the highest bar dues in the nation here in Alaska, one, and two is for taking the bar, how expensive it is, you know, $1,000, and for young people who have literally just come out of school, it's quite a bit. So I just wondered if you had been continuing discussions on the fees, both the bar examination fees themselves and then your annual dues. Are you there?
Just decided to apply for another job.
Is he still there?
Still there. He was cutting out in answers to my questions, too.
Okay.
Maybe he just doesn't want to respond.
Well, we hope you're thinking about it. Do you want to add anything, Representative Kara?
Mr. Fallheber, are you still there? Or if you're there, it sounds like we probably just can't hear you.
Have we offended you, sir? Please speak to us.
I would like you to dialogue with him on those. Those are very important issues.
No one's really gotten back to us on it. Well, why don't we set the name to the side, and hopefully he can call in tomorrow. How's that?
Or later.
It's not working today for some reason. All right. So we are back to House Bill number 257. We were in the middle of public testimony. We were in the middle of Barry Jackson's testimony. Mr. Jackson, are you there?
Apparently, the telecom company just said they were crashing it.
Okay. We'll take a brief at ease. It's a network problem. Is that what the deal is, Secretary? We'll go back online. We're having teleconferencing problems today. We're on House Bill number 257, so what I'll do is go to the Department of Administration to explain the CS first. Mr. Vern Jones, if you don't mind, members are asking about it. It was circulated in our last meeting. If you could just explain.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Vern Jones. I'm the state's chief procurement officer.
Let me interrupt for a second. Madam Chair, when you say the CS, you mean the education CS, the I version, or is there a new CS?
It is a piece of paper that looks like this, that was drafted. It says draft on it, and there is no work number associated with it. My apologies.
So the intention is that this might be the CS that we're going to work.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's hear about why we should consider it, Mr. Jones.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's two changes that we suggest to the committee. One is in line 10 of section 1. There's a reference there. It says that notwithstanding any other provision of this chapter, the contract shall be awarded under AS 3630-100 through 190. That reference limits the department to awarding a contract under this bill to doing so via an invitation to bid. In other words, low bid wins. I would suggest that you change that reference to 190 to 265, and that would allow us to award a contract under the RFP or competitive sealed proposals process, which I think is more appropriate for a contract of this type. The second change is really revamps the preferences sections of the bill, and I won't go through each and every one of them. Suffice it to say, what the bill had done was lift all the preference procurement preference language from existing statute and put it into this bill. And what we have done with our suggested substitute is we've reworked those preferences, because I could tell you from experience that the state's procurement preference laws are clumsy, they're not consistent, they're confusing, and people make mistakes with them. And what we've done here is to provide you with preferences that all the same preferences are there and the same percentage amounts, but they all act consistently. For example, if you get the Alaska bidder preference, that's 5% off of the price that you're offering. Right now in statute, if you qualify for the Alaska disabled bidder preference, first, the procurement person has to get all the proposals in, find which one is the lowest cost, apply the preference to that, and then go take that amount and subtract it from the qualifying disabled person's price offer. It's confusing and it doesn't act the same. The suggestion, the changes we would suggest you make in our draft here, has all the preferences acting consistently, all of them taking the percentage from the price that that qualifying entity is offering. I hope I didn't confuse things, but that is, in general, that's what this does.
Fantastic. So what we would do, what I will do, actually, is offer this as a conceptual amendment, just so we know what we're working from. So this would be a conceptual amendment to version F, which would essentially replace it. I trust what Mr. Jones says. He's the procurement specialist. I trust what he has to say on it, so I would just offer that as conceptual amendment number one.
Madam Chair?
Representative Gruenberg.
I'd like to point out line 17. It says,
page
one, excuse me. This is conceptual amendment number one?
Yes.
It says D to U, and it doesn't appear there's a U. It goes to R.
It's like a typo.
Yeah, okay. So it should be, could we make that D to R?
So as an amendment to the conceptual amendment, line 17, page one, good catch, D to R. And it'll be conceptual, so the drafters can renumber and re-letter accordingly. Is there any objection to that? Okay, so hearing none, we're now working from the amended House Bill 257. Okay, and then, Mr. Jones, I think the other thing I want to understand, and we didn't have a whole lot of time last hearing to get into this, but the bill would eliminate the sunset from the pilot, and it would allow an administration, whether it's this administration or future administrations, should they choose, to expand the use of electronic commerce tools in procurement. And I guess what I want to do is get you worked very closely with me on the first bill, and it was really important to me to have your work, because I had an idea, but I was entering an area that, frankly, I didn't know a whole lot about. I just kind of want to hear from you what your thoughts are about how the program has worked so far, what are some of the things that you think could be improved, and whether or not you believe giving a tool like this to the administration, this administration, or any future is appropriate.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As far as what I think of how it's worked, the program has been up and running for I think in the opinion of the administration that it's still very much in the early stages. We're still analyzing results. I don't think we've come to any conclusions one way or the other. It's frankly, I think, just too new. I know we have varying opinions within the administration on different aspects of how it's working for different applications, but I honestly think that it's really too early to give it a pass-fail or to say much more specifically about it other than they're in there working and I'm not sure what else I can tell you about
and
that.
Then I think the other thing that I want to know is your perspective, because when we work together, one of the things I emphasized to you at that point in time was that I thought this would be a way to create a public-private partnership wherein you've got tools, highly expensive, took a long time to develop and create, both hardware and software tools that allow for e-procurement. Those people, whomever they are, the multiple people that do it, compete for a bid to then partner with folks like yourself that are our state employees that work in the area of procurement. And what I'm trying to understand from, I guess, so more of a personal perspective is, do you think the employees, has it worked for them to learn how to use the smart tools? Do you feel like you remember what my goals were, and are they being achieved at all? Do you think that there's a potential for this to be a savings to the state, to be a rewarding, productive partnership between private and public?
Madam Chair, I think that there's probably a couple answers to that question. At the heart of the HB 313, which created the pilot, and at the heart of this bill is outsourcing of jobs, where we have a shift of state employees doing procurement under the procurement code to a contractor doing the state's procurement for the state under a contract, not under the code. And with that outsourcing comes electronic tools. And from I have no reason to doubt that the tools that the contractors now deployed and are being used are well suited for the application. I have no reason to doubt that they aren't appropriate for the use and don't bring the state forward a measure. I think the differences of opinion here really stem from not from the tools themselves, but from the outsourcing and that policy question of whether the work should be done by employees under a procurement code or whether they should be contracted out and not be subject to that code. So, as I said, we think of this as an experiment. Frankly, it's a pilot. It's not rolled out widely. It's one section of DOT, and we're watching it very closely and frankly waiting for the results.
But I think you agree that no matter what, even if, I mean, obviously the goal in creating efficiencies is bound to produce some job losses. Whether it were the kind of efficiencies that we purchased as a state government, those were some ideas thrown around when 313 came out, which was, why doesn't the state just invest in the capital required to create this software, to build this infrastructure and system? I mean, I think you wouldn't do it if you didn't believe it was going to lead to more centralization and more efficiency. So even under that scenario, some people would probably lose their jobs or be shifted to a different line of work. But I think one thing that you and I have always agreed or talked about, but I want to hear your thoughts on it, is that you still need folks in the state government to be in partnership, if you will, with these folks. And so this idea of outsourcing, it really was never discussed that way when the bill first came through. It was this idea of a partnership, that you have the folks with the expertise and the experience there partnering with the people who are in our state government. So I guess what I just want to hear your final thoughts are is, do you can you envision a program like this, should it go forward to other agencies or to continue on in this working in that fashion?
Well, I certainly think it's possible. Like I said, what we want to be sure of before it's deployed any more widely is that it is successful. We are making gains. There's efficiency improvements there in maybe processing time, cost of goods, cost of purchases, cost of services purchased, and so on before we deploy it any more widely. I think there's a lot of people, or some people rather, that would maybe yourself included, that would like to see us use the existing bill to its fullest extent immediately and see what happens. I think the administration's taking a more cautious approach, deploying it in a narrower scope and just monitoring it for results. We are in the process and have been in the process of determining, at what level do we deploy it further. If this bill were to pass, I couldn't honestly tell you what changes we would make, given that we haven't deployed used the existing legislation to its fullest extent yet. I would say, though, that we're taking an honest look at it, and I think we're going to, in the end, the results will depend on the success and the improvements gained in the agency that it's rolled out in now. I think it'd be hard for anyone to argue that bringing a modern procurement system into the state wouldn't allow us to make improvements. I think the decision here really is a policy decision. How do you want those procurements to happen? Do you want them to happen with state employees under a procurement code, or do you want it contracted out? And that's, again, a policy decision that's, I think, yet to be made on a large scale.
And just the final thing, and then I'll let other members ask, is describe for me, if you can, why was it so difficult to get it going? It wasn't even until 9 months ago that people even finally got off the dime. And just as a policymaker, it's frustrating for me sitting back, and I'm hoping you can help educate me on why it is that, for one thing, we put the potential for four different units, if you will, of the government in there. And I wanted that, and that was the testimony. The folks that supported the bill wanted this to go forward aggressively for 3 years so that we could see if it was going to work in a wide variety of settings, because there are different departments that may be better beneficiaries of this kind of program than others. And I'm just trying to understand, why did it take so long to get going, and what do you perceive to be the resistance? Because, again, your all of your testimony has been based on this idea of proving results and so on. But if the very people whose cooperation is required to let something go forward and determine if it's a success or not won't cooperate, then how do you ever get a measure? So,
Madam Chair, I'll try and take that one at a time. I understand your frustration with the timing, but if you consider what needed to be done before the contractor could make that first purchase, I think it would put it in context. First of all, we're bound by union bargaining agreements that require a feasibility study. So in order to conduct the feasibility study, we hired a contractor to come in and map the agency, describe all the work that was being done there by the state employees, the cost that it was taking. We then issued we did a procurement for that. We awarded that. We got those results. Then we issued a procurement for the actual outsourcing contractor. We had to wait a time. Mandatory
circulation
time.
I didn't even know that
time.
This was going to be part of it. And your point is, even though that wasn't in the bill, that because in some ancillary way it affects.
We were bound to do a feasibility study by our union bargaining agreement. So We did the operational analysis. That was a snapshot of, you know, what was happening with the state. We then got a did an RFP. We got selected the winner, who was ASCII. We compared those two, and those two documents made up the feasibility study. We then had to give that to the union. There's a mandatory time frame that they have to look at that and provide alternate plans. We got alternate plans from both of the unions. We had to mandatory time frame to look at those. Once we got through that, both of those plans were not accepted by the commissioner at the time. And once we got through that, we could make the award. After we made the award, we had a certain time frame that the contractor had to ramp up before their contract started to get ready. Their contract started in July. So we had a lot of work to do, like I said, before that first purchase could be made by the contractor. And there, keep in mind that there are people's jobs being lost in the meantime. And it was a great transition and some turmoil in the agency.
How many jobs have been lost?
I believe there was 10.
That were not relocated to state government? Who has permanently lost a job? Nobody doesn't have a job anymore.
Well, there were 10 positions that were outsourced. The people in those positions, I believe, I couldn't tell you exactly. I know some of them found work elsewhere in state government. I don't know how many of them actually may still be unemployed, but there were 10 positions lost. So there was a lot of work to be done, I guess, is my point, before the contractor could even start. So I think to say that we delayed this any would not be truthful. And I'm sorry, but I might have forgotten the last part of your question.
I absolutely appreciate it, because it's been a mystery to me. And when you just describe all the steps that you have to go through,
Each step subject to challenge.
Now I understand. Representative Garrett, did you have your hand up? I can't remember.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
Just I would follow up on your very last question. I'd ask that you ask the union folks. They can probably tell you that. And Mr. Jones, you, when we were visiting, I think, somebody, if you maybe have an idea if this program continues on, how many jobs will be outsourced or lost? I would say difference may be answered that in two different ways. How many will be outsourced? How many will be eliminated, if you have any?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, it's my understanding that there are approximately 200 procurement positions in the state that could be outsourced if the administration or a future administration were to take full advantage or make full use of this as far as outsourcing. And as far as being lost versus outsourced, I don't think that really there's any difference there.
Well, okay, let me explain what I mean. If those state jobs would go away, how many private jobs would distill out of that, if you know?
Through the chair, I don't know. As an example, I'm not sure it's exactly relevant, but there were 10 DOT Southeast Region jobs outsourced, and I believe the contractor has employed 6 full-time.
We'll ask them. Thank you, Mr. Jones. I appreciate it. Representative
Garrett. Thanks, Madam Chair. I've got a few questions and I'm trying to get up to speed on this bill as quick as I can. I've gotten a lot of emails, and I guess a few of them have suggested that this current pilot project is going to be audited. Have there been audits so far? Is there going to be a final audit at some point? What's the status? Is there any sort of outside review for us to get a glimpse into how the pilot project's working?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, there have been several audits. There has been an audit by OMB that was essentially a contract compliance audit. We, in General Services, administer this contract. We do quarterly benchmarking audits. So far, we have the first quarter audited, and the second quarter we have the results back from the cost of goods portion only. We are spending a lot of time auditing and examining the quality work and the results here. That is all the auditing that I know of, but that's a lot.
Are the audits, I don't understand what the audits are. The internal ones, are they comparing whether this is saving money or are they comparing something else?
Through the chair, our audits are, our audits look at several things. They look at the cost of goods. They look at times to process orders, utilization of Alaska vendors, and they look at also mistakes and errors made by the contractor. And those are done by our staff internally.
Are the audits, in, apart from, are the audits intended to show us whether this is saving money over not having the pilot program, or are you auditing just whether they're complying with statutes? I guess what I'm looking for is, are there audits that show whether this is the pilot project has been saving money? A and B. When is there going to be a final audit? When is the current pilot project going to be over so we can get a final audit?
Through the chair, one of the things that we do measure in one of our benchmarks is movement of costs of goods and services purchased by the contractor, and comparing that to cost of goods and services purchased by the state. So yes, that's one of the things that we do in our benchmarking. The other question was, when's the final audit going to be done? Well, we do these quarterly, and the contract, unless this bill were to pass or some other legislation were to amend the contract, would end June 30th, and presumably we would have some audit at that point to wrap the thing up.
That'll be the final audit for the pilot project, June 30th of this year, or that'll just be the next quarterly audit?
I'm sorry, June 30th, 06 is when the contract is due to end currently, unless it's amended, which would require a change in the sunset date of HB 313. So that's what we're working under now.
And part of the concern in why this bill is here now is that because it got started so late, there isn't the ability to carry the full thing through. The other part of the bill is obviously the permissive language to allow, and this is a result of a lot of discussions back and forth, because I didn't want to mandate it. I mean, you certainly don't want to mandate something that may not work. Besides the fact that, you know, this is a separate branch of government and all those things, but I certainly wanted it to be available in the event that there was a particular commissioner or a particular agency that felt that this is a program that could work for them. I think you have to have the buy-off from those people, though. You can see what happens when you try to force it. But that's really the point, is that we're bumping up against the sunset now. So, okay, well, let me at least get to some other folks. Is that okay? I'm told that teleconference is working for a brief. Nope, it's not. Already the window's closed. Okay, so, all right. Next, I'm just going in order of the people that there's a bunch of people online. My apologies to them. Okay, Kevin Brooks? Nope. Okay. So, yeah, Representative Gruenberg.
I just want to be sure, and I'm kind of asking the folks from the unions who are here. Are we supposed to have both memos dated April 8 and April 12? Are they both current, or should we toss one of them? We have two.
There's an April 12 that deals with constitutional questions, I think.
Yeah, and are we supposed to have the April 8th also?
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Scott Hawkins, you haven't testified yet? Want to testify? Okay. And then, Mr. Duncan, you asked for some more time, even though you already testified, so I'll give you time after. And then after that, I'm done with people here in the room and just continuing to try to see if we can connect up to the folks online. So if I haven't called your name, that means your name is not on my list. Welcome to House Judiciary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Hawkins. I'm here representing Alaska Supply Chain Integrators. First, a bit about ASCII. We were founded in 1999 in Anchorage about 6 years ago this month to provide purchasing, warehousing, other aspects of supply chain management to the North Slope oil fields and gradually to others. We've grown to about 150 employees in those 6 years and developed a full suite of e-commerce tools here in Alaska that compete with some of the best e-commerce tools available nationwide and worldwide. And those tools transact, we use those tools to transact business on behalf of our customers and to deliver streamlining, automation, cost savings, that type of thing. As a side note, we're a significant employer of graduates from the UAA Global Logistics Program. We have a number of them, current students and recent grads on our staff, both in Anchorage and on the North Slope. Overall, we see a future in back office business process operation for in Alaska here and elsewhere. And we see that in both the public and private sector. Procurement is a perfect example of a back office administrative function that's really not the primary business of any organization, typically, unless you're like us and choose to specialize in it. But it's the type of back office function that a specialist can come in and really take seriously, bring in specialized tools, that type of thing, and deliver serious value. As you know, House Bill 313 was passed in 2003. Through a competitive RFP process, there were two proposers, and we were selected as the contractor to operate the pilot program, which we have been operating since July of 2004, and which began very small, as Vern Jones pointed out earlier, with the DOT Southeast region. We support House Bill 257. It eliminates what in retrospect was a fairly short sunset put on the pilot procurement program. And it also expands the authorization and provides a little more flexibility for the program to kind of find its optimal value. I'd like to share with you how the program's been going from the perspective of the contractor or operator of the program, us. First and foremost, we take a good deal of pride in the fact that the program have indeed been delivered. There are personnel cost savings, and I think in your packet or distributed to you earlier are some slides that kind of generally follow my testimony. And there's a slide that says cost savings achieved. And it gives you the current estimates of personnel cost savings for the 2 year.
Page four.
Yes.
Right.
That's right.
Page four.
Page four, Madam Chairman. The personnel cost savings are over the 2 year term of the agreement from July of 2004 through June of 2006. That is based on the state's feasibility study and is based on what our contract will pay us compared to what the previous personnel costs of the previous staff cost the state. And so those are very hard figures. The cost of goods, the catalog purchases figure of $36,000, that is based on a recent snapshot of, that's actually based on a recent report taken from catalog data taken from transactions. And that's based on nearly 1,000 transactions over the first 6 months of operating the web tools, the e-commerce web tools. And it's based on apples-to-apples catalog data. And what it shows is that to the degree that we can get spend as the program envisioned, to the degree that we can establish a catalog, map items to existing state agreements or establish new competitive agreements and enforce those agreements through a standardized catalog mechanism, cost savings can be delivered. That figure represents the most recent quarter of the first quarter of calendar 2005, the third fiscal quarter of the program. And that quarter shows a 3.3% decline in cost of goods off of catalog spend. And if you extrapolate just that figure forward for the remaining quarters of the program, and if you assume no further catalog penetration, no further expansion of the catalog, no further usage of the catalog, only what's been done to date so far in the transition, that's the cost of goods impact that you can see. So in total, if you add those two together, you're looking at nearly $200,000 over the first term of the agreement. And I think, you know, given the very small scale and given the fact that we're in the initial stages of a startup, we're very proud of those results and believe that they do bode very well for the potential value of the program.
Scott, in real terms, you, for folks who haven't seen, you know, your full presentation in years past, when House Bill 313 was going through, maybe you can just explain in real terms what the concept is when for companies like BP and others, you've gone in and been able to save the millions of dollars. What's the basic concept behind what you do?
Well, the basic concept is that we come in, we don't actually buy the goods and take ownership of them and resell them. We simply operate the processes on behalf of the customer. So a purchase order for BP, for example, goes out as a BP purchase order. A purchase order for the state of Alaska or a contract for the state of Alaska is written on state of Alaska procurement forms. But what we do is we come in and through the use of these web tools, through a very intensive process of measuring metrics and those types of things, process control, by specializing and taking it seriously and managing this process very intensively on a day-to-day basis, we're typically able to deliver cost savings of 25% to 40% in the overhead of actually just operating the administrative processes. The cost of goods are over and above that. And that depends a lot on, you know, where a customer is, how good a job do they do of managing their current spend. But with our tools like reverse auctions, tools like getting catalog agreements set up and getting competitive situations in place, we can deliver cost of goods savings going forward too. And that's just a matter of how much of that there is really just kind of depends on what you experience as you go forward.
Madam Chair, for some reason I don't have this chart that everybody else has. I think I probably have it and I can't find it. When you started talking about cost savings, the Mr. Jones, I believe it was talking about some audits they've been doing. Are your conclusions coming from their audits, or are your conclusions coming from some other review of whether there have been cost savings?
Our conclusions are not coming from their audits, Representative Guerra, Madam Chair. Our conclusions are based on a very large number of transactions. Basically, it's the universe of transactions that are done against the catalog that we set up for the pilot program. The results in the state quarterly benchmark reports, the reason we ran that report and presented those comparisons today is because we're very concerned about the methodology that's being used, and not so much the methodology, but the way that methodology is being applied and interpreted in these reports. Those reports, as they were explained to us early on, are quarterly benchmarking snapshots. They're meant to be a snapshot of data that's taken every quarter, and it kind of rolls forward and over time creates kind of a cumulative picture of the program. Over time, it's increasingly valid, but it was never intended, in our understanding, to provide a quarterly program review that says, okay, based on this snapshot, things are going great, things are going poor, we can draw conclusions about the program. The cost of goods analysis for the first quarter, I'll give you an example. The first quarter benchmarking review had a grand total of 7 transactions in the cost of goods review. Those 7 showed, such as they were, they showed an increase of about 2.3% over historical transactions for those 7 transactions. That, if it were valid, would have been about in line with inflation. For the second quarter, we've heard opponents of the program characterize that the second quarter audit will show dramatic increases. Well, we were concerned about that, so we called to check it out. Yes, that quarterly snapshot was underway, and about 30 transactions had been identified to where some comparison could be found to an earlier purchase that was made. And based on those 30, I believe in total the increase is, I think it's something, at least the draft that I saw, I don't believe it's been finalized and released yet, but the draft that I've seen as the contractor shows that it's about 16% up based on those 30 transactions. But those 30 transactions, if you look at the dollar amounts involved, that represents about $262. And those 30 transactions do not begin to approach a statistically valid sample in our view. So what we've done, we've understood that those results that are supposed to be kind of lessons learned, they're not supposed to be a statistically valid sample. But that's how they're being characterized by some, as though they were a statistically valid sample. So we said, well, we'd better go in and get a much larger sample and see what we're seeing. And based on 972 transactions, which is statistically valid, we show a decline in the most recent quarter of 3% on cost of goods. Though, again, those are based on what we've got in the catalog, and I think why we're seeing that, it really goes to the heart of the use of e-commerce tools and the use of systems. What happens is that when you get a system like this in place, you can get the state's agreements that are out there and available to be used hardwired into the system, if you will, and that's what we've done. So when a demand arises and when something is purchased, it is purchased at the best price available to the state. It's not an informal situation where sometimes the contract's used and sometimes it's not. You get more rigor and more discipline in the process. So I hope that answers your question.
So at one point, a discussion that we had as well was when in early stages you had to require employees to use the catalog. So in essence, if an employee decided not to use the catalog, the cost savings would never be realized and you would never be able to show that cost savings. But what you're saying now is you're getting to that point where you're able to force that so that this competitive, I guess it's reverse auction, occurs and the best price comes up, and that's what it is.
Madam Chair, the reverse auction is one tool that we can use to set up agreements, but just the daily system itself, just the process of going into the smart catalog tool, finding your items in the catalog, and ordering them ensures that the best pricing available to the state under its existing contracts is the price that gets paid, the price that gets used. So that system creates a framework that enforces the agreements, a framework that's otherwise absent in the other agencies of the state.
Two other topics I want you to touch on as well, and then I know there'll be questions before we want to wrap up. We've got to get Representative Coghill's bill out today as well, is that some of the statements that have been made, and you know, this is not a new concept. I mean, there are many, many, many states, municipalities, and school districts in the United States that have chosen to privatize their procurement, for sure. Some of the criticisms that have been made are, well, Title 32 is, it's been even suggested to me, it's a great procurement code. I personally disagree. That being said, that is our state procurement code. In Title 32, there are some great things. For example, requiring that we look at Alaskan-owned businesses, businesses owned by minorities or women or people with disabilities, that we want to sort of give a shot to them. The Buy Alaska, you know, where it's an Alaskan-made product. Please describe for us, first of all, what's in the bill regarding that, how you have conducted that in your own in your other contracts with respect to preferences, and then also what you do in terms of integrity. And I think that's one of the things that I want to hear you personally, as one businessman in this particular arena. The discussion has been, well, you know, this has to be a state function, because if you give this to or allow a private partner to enter in at all, there's corruption, potential, and they're gonna shift these purchases to their friends and all these other things. So I just kind of want you while we have you in person, to talk a little bit about your philosophies with that and how that plays out in reality. Because I think that's the heart of the policy question for some people is this a state function? Is this something the government should be doing? Is it like public safety? Is it like being a state coroner? Or is it something that can, in fact, be privatized in some way?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's an excellent question, and that, I think, does go to the heart of the policy question, because this is new stuff. You know, pretty much everything that's contracted out to the private sector by government at one time along the way was considered controversial. You can go way, way back in history to a time when even construction was controversial to contract out and was done by government employees. So contracting out something new that hasn't been contracted by a government before is always difficult. So I appreciate the question. The procurement is a perfect candidate for this type of thing, because it's very back office and administrative. As the agent for the state, we don't make a decision to spend any money. The requisition comes to us, the budget authority comes to us, and our job is to simply carry that out. If there's a significant amount of money involved, there's always a committee of end users, a proposal evaluation review committee that makes the final decision. And what we end up doing is really performing clerical administrative services. In terms of the inherent integrity, I would submit to you that that corruption happens everywhere, and governments are not immune. Government employees are not immune. You can see examples in history of government employees having committed those types of things. In the case of a private contractor, there's a great deal to lose. This is our business. If we were ever found to be steering business to a crony or anything like that, it would hurt the entire company, would hurt the value of the company. I would submit to you that we have a great deal more to lose and a great deal more incentive to keep it pristine. Governments are not the only institutions that are concerned with this type of thing. The other big clients of ours, such as the oil companies, are also very concerned with that type of thing. They have shareholders that care a great deal about that type of thing. And again, the standards of conduct are very, very high. And there as well, if we were ever caught, if we were ever found to be doing anything like that, it would be devastating to the company. And so we are extremely vigilant and extremely concerned and watch that type of thing very carefully. Because there's, in our business, if we aspire to grow and really turn this into a much larger Alaska success story than it already is, our reputation has got to be very, very clean.
And you didn't have a problem when you and I discussed at one point the idea that there were folks that did want to make sure that some of these preferences were part of what was applied to anybody.
That's correct.
Whether it's government or private, and that's something that...
By Alaska's near and dear to our heart, as an Alaskan company, we relate to that 100%. And the preferences... There were not preferences in the original House Bill 313, I think more out of a desire to just keep the bill simple than anything else, and out of a thought that, those preferences could maybe be applied administratively. But we have no objection. In fact, we support abiding by those preferences, because we're not here to change the shape of the playing field for Alaska businesses. As an Alaska business, if we had it our way, we would strengthen the playing field, if you don't mind my tortured analogy here. But we've also got in our contract a requirement that we take a proactive stance on BuyAlaska. And I think at the end of the day, to be effective at BuyAlaska, it's not just a matter of applying preferences. I think the statistics show that the preferences seldom make a difference, that it's the exception rather than the rule that the preferences are decisive. Where it really matters is when you're creating the specifications and the framework for a procurement and making sure that you're not doing it in such a way that it inherently excludes Alaska businesses or inherently advantages an out-of-state business. So I think there's a great deal that can be done on this subject that even goes beyond preferences.
Hey, Representative Guerra. And then I'm told people are back online. I don't know if it's true. But
I'm just going to share this with the committee. It's very difficult to sit here and hear the state say that costs, it shows that the studies show the costs have gone up since we started this, and then listen to your testimony, the costs have gone down since it started, and we don't seem to have any of the audits. And it's not fair to the witnesses to make them say I'm right, and then the other person come in and say I'm right. Do you have a copy of these audits that everybody's talking about? Can we get a copy of these audits?
Yeah, as soon as they're released, the first quarter one is released. You may even have one in your packet. The second fiscal quarter one, I don't know if it's released yet or not, but my point earlier is that these audits are not meant, they're not designed to provide an answer to the question of what have cost of goods done. They're extremely small samples. They're based on non-catalog data, which is, you know, you do your best to find a historical purchase that resembles the one that you're looking at. The jury is still very much out. The best data we have that I'm submitting to you is the 972 transactions that are based on the catalog, where you have a very high likelihood of an apples-to-apples comparison. You have a very large number of transactions. And I would submit to you that if you look at the two data sets, one will support conclusions, the other one will not.
You just said the jury is still out, and that seems to be what we've been hearing. And then you also said before that as we get more information, it'll become more statistically relevant. So why are we not just waiting until the pilot project is done with and we have a final audit? Why am I going to make a decision now without audits in front of me, when I could make a decision later when the audits have been done? Tell me as a matter of policy why I should jump at this now.
Okay. Well, several reasons, Representative Guerra, Madam Chair. One is the sunset on the program is fast approaching. There's about 14 months left in it. To expand it any further, right now it's being tried on an extremely small scale. In fact, it's our view that it's being tried on a scale that's way too small to really demonstrate the full value. Nonetheless, value is being demonstrated. I mentioned earlier to somebody that to us it's a bit like demonstrating the value of a backhoe in a sandbox. You can move a little bit of sand and show how it's going to work, but you're not going to really demonstrate the full capabilities of that backhoe. And that's, I think, what we're looking at here. Plus, as I mentioned earlier, the time on the program is running out. And as you look at it, we have shown, I think, compelling cost savings, both in the overhead and in a very strong set of data, a very strong set of catalog data here. By any reasonable standards, if you look at this, we've come into a very difficult situation on a very small scale and had to put a very large scalable system in place. This is all coming forward. This transition is occurring, and it's occurring successfully. My comment earlier, Representative Guerra, is that we will be in a transition for some time. The full value of the program, to where we can show you absolutely indisputable benefits over time, that's going to emerge over a period of years. But currently, I think it's very important that the policymakers allow the program more time and allow it more flexibility to find its optimal application in the different agencies.
Representative Guerra.
My problem is different than yours. It's given the nature of my job. We've heard testimony that we might, that, and I suppose it's the biggest number possible, but we might lose 200 jobs if we make this decision. The jury's still out. You said something about let this run its course, and I thought you didn't just say that.
Not in that context.
I guess I don't have any other questions. I'll just share my concern, which is that I think I'm a little worried that it's premature to make a decision until we find out how the program's worked through some sort of valid audit. It's my
Representative Guerra, Madam Chair, you wouldn't be hard-pressed to find a program anywhere in state government any time in history that's more carefully scrutinized and audited than this one. In fact, I would submit to you that it's to the degree that it's excessive. When you run a white glove test in the middle of a remodel project, you're bound to pick up some dust. And I think that's what we're seeing. But we're also seeing that the remodel project is coming along very well and looking very good, and that we ought to move forward and gradually, responsibly build it out to its full potential.
Yeah, and I'll just, as a sponsor, I'll just say what my, you know, intent in it, again, is that because of the extreme delay and frustration in not getting people to cooperate to get this thing going, now we're running up against a deadline, and I want this administration, there are some people in the administration that want the tool, that think it will work. There are others that don't think it would work for their department. But I would like them to have the ability to expand it. The problem is, under the current language right now, it's too late really to get any other department up and going under the auspices of the pilot, because that sunset is coming up too quickly. Now, if they would have done what my original intent was 2 years ago and put a couple different agencies into it, and they'd been up and running now for a little bit, that would be more helpful. But because of that, we're now in a situation where you know, we've sort of just got this one thing going forward. My concern is that there are other departments that would like to use the tool that can't, that feel like they have their hands tied. That's one, and then the other is the sunset. I am willing to keep discussing how it ends up. I would, my preference would be if my committee would allow me to let this bill get out today into finance. The other bill is in the Senate Finance Committee, and there are some discussions taking place about how all this could come together in a different way. But I want to keep the pressure on because, frankly, if I don't do it, nobody will. I mean, nobody will. It's one of those things where I want to almost go so far as to say I feel like it's being sabotaged. I feel like it's a direct threat to the very people who are required to for success to comply with it. And so I'm trying to send a message. I'm trying to get a tool out there. I've been working with the administration on what's the best way to do it. I don't think forcing it is the right way, but I do think setting some sidebars and saying it's an optional tool, you know, without a sunset is a good way. But I have, you know, like I say, I just have grave concerns about how it's all played out. I think there are just people at the root of it who feel threatened by it and don't want to help see it through. So that's the intent behind the bill. That's the reason that it's here now. You know, the mayor of Anchorage, I was just slipped a note to Nancy. It was so embarrassing this campaign season because I was so behind this and so excited about this, and I couldn't even get my own idea up and going. There was nothing I could do because it required a different branch of government to get moving. And the mayor's on the radio, you know, every single day between August and October talking about this great procurement, e-procurement stuff that he's doing in Anchorage, and he is doing it there, and it's fabulous. But I would like to give our state a chance to see if we can create some efficiencies in this area. I believe we can. Representative Vera.
The frustration I understand, and I understand I'm going to start experiencing it if our PE task force bill goes through, and no task force ever convenes, right? There seems to be a jump between saying the state should engage in e-procurement, which I think it should, and saying that we have to outsource that. And that's another question I have. I mean, if we need to modify the state law so the state can do much more vigorous e-procurement like the city is, that's one thing. But I don't understand why we have to outsource that function.
I just want to interject as well. I think Mr. Hawkins is a hero for what he's done, and I think he's been innovative, and I applaud this. I obviously can feel for state employees as well, and it's that public policy balance. You don't want to see people lose their jobs, but I assume at least I can point to some folks that ran in their most recent election and in past elections on the idea that we we look at outsourcing as a way to make efficiencies. I think the dilemma here, and you brought it up, is that we don't have audits back yet. But I think this, conversely, it's kind of the needs of the many and what is more important in terms of the weighing. And I think it's more important that we move on with this, as Representative McGuire stated, and at least keep assessing it, but in addition, keep giving you the tools so that you can expand what you're doing. And I just super quick, I could see we're going to get in a philosophical debate, which I love. Representative Guerra is probably the best, and I think he's the best on the committee in terms of explaining when he has something at issue. But what I fear is that now we've had a teleconference delay, hopefully you keep these people limited to 2 minutes each, and we can still get the bill out if the committee concurs, rather than, you know, because, I mean, we could just kill the bill today on philosophical differences. And I don't want to see that happen.
Madam Chair.
You're in the middle of a committee discussion.
See that, and I guess I'll cut my testimony off. If I could make two more quick points.
Maybe I'm missing something, Mr. Hawkins, through the chair. You pointed to the chart on page 4, and you had talked about various types of cost savings, but at least according to this chart, if we have a total cost savings of $200,000, it looks very close to me that 80% of that is reduced from cutting out people's jobs.
Representative Greenberg, Madam Chair, it is correct that the hard dollar cost savings that we can say for certain right now are in the cost of administration and overhead. And we are doing with 6 people what was previously done by state employees of 10 people. And that is correct.
What you're saying through the chair is if you automate and you cut out people's jobs, then it may be cheaper. That sounds to me like what this is about.
That's part of what it's about. But I would also point out that the premise of the program is this rigor and catalog and system framework. We've done some review from state financial reports looking at third-party spend, and if we could deliver this, just the 3% reduction that we've seen already, and if we could deliver just that number across the entire spend, that would equate to between $15 and $20 million a year in cost savings.
How many jobs would be lost?
Well, we don't know, because there will always be a role for state procurement officers. There's always going to be the types of procurement that are more suitable for state employees. One prime example is construction procurement. That's large dollar, high risk procurement that, frankly, as a contractor, we're not that excited about. There's other large specialized procurements that do make up a significant amount of activity. So it's hard to say at the end of the day how many would be affected, but that's comes to the point of why the expansion is important, is that in any given agency you may not take on the entire piece. This is really about more the low dollar repetitive types of things that lend themselves to streamlining and automation, and finding that economic sweet spot across several agencies is probably more feasible than trying to fully implement a smaller number of agencies.
The thing I'm concerned about, and I'm just represent Mountain View, where a lot of people work for a living. And, you know, in my area, you all know that there's the Northway Mall. And a few years ago, there was a Kmart there, and there's no longer a Kmart. And they're thinking about doing something else with it, but there's no longer a Kmart anyway. They're going to be Home Depot. Jobs will be back. And I looked at this with actually, I think I talked to Representative Wyrock about this. But a few years ago in Congress, there was a real issue when plants were closed. And there was what came out of that with the Plant Closure Act. And it's really the same issue here. If we're going to be downsizing and making things more efficient, which does make sense, we're going to see people lose their jobs.
which is harmful to those people who lose their jobs and the people who depend on them. So how do we redirect their employability? What do we do to the people who lose their jobs? How do we keep them employed? And this is not just your responsibility, Mr. Hawkins. You just happen to be the guy in the hot seat on this bill. And I'm not taking off after you. I'm kind of looking at the other members of the committee, because we have a responsibility not to keep everybody employed at governmental expense, but to have a healthy economy. And like everything else, you can spin it one way or the other, and you can talk about governmental efficiency or people losing their jobs. But it's the same issue, regardless of how you term it. So what are we going to do?
Representative Gruenberg, Madam Chair, affecting the employment of existing state employees is our least favorite part of this whole proposition. It's not something we relish. What we experienced here in the first phase of the pilot, 10 positions affected, a handful of those were due for retirement, took that opportunity to retire. The remainder, as far as we know, have filled other vacant positions in state governments, those that have wanted to work. As far as we know, nobody that wants a job has been permanently without one. There was a short period of transition time while they filled those vacancies. We would be very supportive of anything that would provide some transition assistance. We made job offers to all of the non-retiring procurement staff, and in that particular case, we did not get any takers. I believe largely or partly because of the desire to stay within the state's retirement system. But as we move forward, I would expect that to change, particularly if there's a perception that the political will exists within this body and that this is an ongoing long-term program. I believe employees would be more inclined to join our company or a company like ours. They would have an opportunity to be part of a technology-driven enterprise. That option would be there. But for those that want to do something else and change careers, we would be very positive on transition assistance, that type of thing, because, as I said, we don't relish that aspect of this process of creative, economists call it creative destruction. That process has winners and losers, and we sympathize with that.
Representative Coghill.
And I appreciate the representative bringing up the question. We do have a kind of a in-state job preference program where a job comes on available, and those within the state are actually able to apply for it. So there are some preferences there. And I think the answer to the question some time ago on what's happened to those, some have stayed in employment. However, I sense probably from the invention of the wheel until now, this has been a continuing problem on whatever efficiencies. So once that PC was invented, that changed the employment scene, but it certainly hasn't kept anybody from ever being employed. So I think, you know, philosophically we can go down that road, but an improved system always raises the whole level of employment. And so it is tough, though, because there's change involved. I'm generally predisposed to however we can privatize.
That it was me calling.
So I've looked at this with great interest, but I share the chairman's concern and the sponsor of the bill in that you try to go in a direction of, first of all, do no harm, but do better. And I think the amendment that we had on line 13 of rolling back where we're at and maybe unifying some of these things makes a better procurement system and allows us to expand a private procurement system. So I've been satisfied that you're making a little better efficiency within the department, you're getting a better efficiency for the department, and I think jobs can flow between departments. And so I'm actually perfectly satisfied that we're going in a good direction. I've been watching it because of that harm issue of just kind of ripping through the system. And there's so many maze in here that the only shall that I see in this whole bill apart from the effective date, is that they have to live according to the code. So I appreciate that. I just wanted to bring that up since we delved into the philosophy of it.
Representative Groenberg.
Madam Chair, we heard some testimony last week. I don't remember if we fully heard from the unions on this.
Yeah, we're going to hear. Did you wrap up?
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
We are. And are the folks really online? They really are? Okay. Why don't I hear, do you want to complete your testimony, Mr. Duncan? And then he had already testified, Representative Groenberg.
That's, but I do recall.
Gave him the courtesy to do it again, and then I'll go to the folks online.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to testify some more. I was rushed, I thought, the last time, and I appreciated the time crunch you were under. My name, for the record, my name is Jim Duncan. I'm business manager for the Alaska State Employees Association, and I want to talk about several issues today, some which is new. First of all, I would like to hand out, if I could, for the committee, a copy of the second quarter audit. I know Representative Guerra had been asking about that, and that is the document that was given to me. I had asked the Department of Administration last week, Deputy Commissioner Brooks, if he could keep me updated on what's going on, and this was given to me today. It's the cost of goods portion of the quarterly pilot contract. That's what Mr. Jones was referring to, and I don't want to get into a battle of figures or numbers here between the contractor and the state. Let me just say that we, the unions, did not develop these figures. The contractor developed his figures. The state's developing their figures, and we're asking the administration to give us the audit report. And if you'll flip to page 3, which is the there's a chart there, you will see that they have two tables, table 1 and table 2, items purchased by Southeast Region in fourth quarter FY04. They compare that ASCI purchase total to the Southeast Region purchase total. And in table 1, they show a 3.3% increase for cost of goods and services with those purchases. In table 2, they show another grouping, and they show a 70% increase in cost. Now, that 70% is a little bit misleading because it depends on how large the total purchases are. But the bottom line, if you go to the bottom line, you'll see the ASCI combined purchase total was 1602.56. The Southeast Region combined purchase total, 1340.56. Combined additional cost to state is about a 17% increase, 16.3% increase. And these are figures developed by the state, not by the union, nor by the contractor. But by the state. So I wanted to be sure that was on the record and that you had a copy of that. That does not, you might be able to make that figure look differently if you put in the reduction of salaries as the contractor did. But this is actual cost of goods purchased, an increase of 16.3% on the data that's been provided by the state of Alaska. So I wanted to be sure that that was on the record. That's new information from last time. Last time you had the first quarter audit. This is the second quarter audit. We do not yet have the third quarter audit. Also,
Madam Chair.
Representative Groenberg?
So you're saying that rather than cost savings achieved, I'm looking at page 4 of their slide, it would actually be a negative figure. And the only savings that were increased was because people were fired or lost their jobs.
That's correct. That's what the second quarter audit says. Second quarter audit says the bottom line additional cost to the state on items purchased, 16.348% increase in cost of goods purchased. That's exactly correct.
That would seem logical. If you fire people, you save money.
Yes. If you fire people, you save
money. But let's be careful. I mean, again, you have to compare this again side by side, and I think you both make good points, but to the testimony of Mr. Hawkins, that it's very difficult when you're doing these quarterly reports. They're not designed really to elicit the kind of narrowly tailored information you might necessarily want. But I see your point. The other part, I guess, big problem I have is I just wish people could have cooperated so that it would have gotten going sooner, so that it wouldn't only be 9 months into it and that you really could see. So it has to be all taken together, for sure.
Appreciate that, Madam Chair. I just want to be sure that audit report was before you. If I could make, if it's okay, I'd like to make two or three other points, and then I'll try to wrap up. The statement was made, and I just want to be sure that, and I do have some background in this area. As you know, I served in the legislature for 24 years, worked with the procurement code when it was passed in 1985 and as a legislator, and then I served as commissioner of administration and did oversee procurement for 2.5 years. So I do have some background in this. Let me say that there is no amendment needed to the state procurement code to do e-procurement in the state of Alaska. E-procurement can be done by the state under the current procurement code as written. All it takes is the tools, is for you to allow them to have the tools, the programs, to do e-procurement, and they can do that. Secondly, let me say that there is no city or state that has outsourced procurement. It has not been done. The city of Anchorage included. The city of Anchorage has not outsourced procurement. I applaud Mayor Begich for looking at efficiencies and better ways to do procurement. He's being successful in that, but it's still being done by the city of Anchorage. It's still a governmental function. They have not outsourced it. The state of Alaska can do it more efficiently, I have no doubt. They can use e-procurement. And let me just say, representing the union that I represent, 8,000 members, if things can be done more efficiently with state government, we would work with you to do that. Even if it did mean, maybe if it was more efficient, we may lose some positions through attrition and through other methods, but we'd work with you to do things more efficient. We've always been committed to doing government efficiently, and we would continue to work with you to do that. So there has been no state or city government that's outsourced procurement, and I passed out to you last time, I wanted to go back to that, a document, a circular, OMB circular number A76, from the Bush administration, from the Office of Management Budget in 2003, May of 2003, that said that there are some inherently government activities and those should be performed with government personnel. And one of the activities they identified is inherently governmental, is exerting the ultimate control over the acquisition, use, or disposition of United States property, real or personal, tangible or intangible, including establishing policies or procedures for protection, control, or disbursement of appropriated and other federal funds. Even the federal government, under the Bush administration, is saying don't privatize procurement. It's an inherently governmental function and does not lend itself to privatization. So I just wanted to be sure that I was able to reemphasize that. The couple other...
Representative Gruber.
Why? What's the policy behind what the Bush administration says in paragraph B1A4?
I think if you look at B1A, you'll find the reason behind that. And it says, an inherently governmental activity is an activity that is so intimately related to the public interest as to mandate performance by government personnel. These activities require the exercise of substantial discretion in applying government authority and or in making decisions for government. And it goes on to say, process related to oversight of monetary transactions or entitlements. When you're expending federal dollars on large purchases, you're purchasing either federal property or, in this case, purchasing state property, I think the public, there's a level of trust that the public expects that the process is going to be handled in a very professional, competitive manner, and that they should have that level of trust and be sure that when government expenditures happen, that it's being done under some very strict guidelines. That's right. What the procurement code brings about.
Thank you. I'm getting at something else, too.
I'm sure.
You have given to us two memoranda, legal memoranda, and isn't there another reason that there are great constitutional problems?
Madam Chair, through the Chair, yes, Representative Gruber, and I was going to refer back to that. I did hand out a memorandum that we had at the last meeting, didn't get a chance to talk about it in great detail, that does talk about constitutional problems with the legislation as it's constructed. I can't find my copy of it, but it does talk about equal protection grounds.
Are you looking for one of the memos?
April 8th memo.
Here it is.
I have it right in front of me. I just found it. The April 8th memo. And the public policy of, and the constitutional problems it might create of equal protection for individuals and for businesses. Denies Alaska businesses, referring directly to this legislation, would deny Alaska businesses and individuals the equal protection of the laws because it sets one contractor aside above others and, of course, does not apply equal access necessarily to businesses. So I think that is really, and that's why I think it's appropriate this bill be in this committee, in Judiciary Committee. I think there is a serious constitutional question that you folks should want to be reviewing and to be looking at.
Thank you, Mr. Duncan. I just, my final question I wanted to ask you, I asked you in my office, but I just want to ask you on the record. If Title 32, and this is just how I phrased it to you, is such a good procurement code, why are there 47 exemptions to it? And why would we allow our own university that's funded out of state funds to be exempted out of our state procurement code and potentially, I guess, putting themselves in this constitutional peril that you're discussing?
Well, it's Title 36, Madam Chair. Title 36, it was a procurement code that was put in place in 1985 after the difficulty with a former administration. It was a model code at that time and was a code endorsed by the American Bar Association. Since that time, various groups have come before the legislature, and you understand how this works. Various groups have come before the legislature, and because of their ability to influence the process in certain ways, have gotten exemptions, or in the case of the university, a more major exemption. So I'm not suggesting that all those were the correct things to do, but they happened during the legislative process. I am suggesting, however, contrary and with all due respect to Representative Coghill, this bill, House Bill 257, exempts procurement purchases from the procurement code, does not require the contractor to comply with the procurement code. The one thing about the exemptions are they were done by the legislature as a policymaking body. And the procurement code you have in place now, in Title 36, is a procurement code that went through a legislative process, a public hearing process, and individuals such as I and those others who are here and on teleconference had a chance to participate in that. And finally, you set the rules for procurement, so the public knows what the rules are. Under this bill, you, the legislature, would no longer set the rules. You're saying, put those rules aside and let the rules for procurement be determined by the private contractor and the administration. You've lost all transparency. The public would not be aware what those rules are. You would not be assured that they're going to have competitive procedures in them. You would not be assured that a vendor would have the right to appeal an award or protest an award. The rules would be between what the contractor might negotiate and what the administration might negotiate.
Right, but and just to be fair, and then I want to get to these folks that are online, to be fair, I mean, the implication is pretty on the edge there because, for example, in 313 when we went forward, it was always clear, and Vern Jones was there as well, that you did, in order to allow something like this to go forward, you had to exempt it from Title 36 because, again, with all due respect, the code frankly doesn't work in a lot of places. That's why people like the University of Alaska have exempted themselves out of the code. That being said, it was never my intent, and I hope you're not suggesting that today, to allow private industry that is unscrupulous to come into this state without any sideboards and no negotiations or contracts spelled out. And I hope you wouldn't imply this administration would allow that either, that the I's would be dotted and the T's would be crossed regarding how these auctions would take place, regarding what the sidebars are regarding procurement.
Madam Chair, I used none of those terms. I made none of those inferences. All I said was that with a procurement code that's in statute, it's done in a public process and that it's debated in a public process. And there's testimony on the code, and you, the legislature, finally vote on it. Under this piece of legislation, and I'm not implying that anything would ever go wrong, I'm not talking badly about ASCI or about this administration. All I am saying is that all of a sudden the process is not done in the public. It's done as a negotiation between a contractor and some administration. It may not even be this administration. It may be an administration of my party sometime in the future if we are ever so fortunate to get one elected again. But I don't even think that would be correct. I don't even think that would be correct. So I appreciate your concern, but I surely was not implying any wrongdoing on the part of anyone at this time or in the future. I was just saying the public does have a right to know. And if I could,
President Grunberg, I'm going to go to the public. I'm going to cut myself off too.
Could I just say one thing, please?
Briefly, Representative Grunberg.
Representative Duncan, and I were in the legislature when that procurement code was passed. With respect to the university, my recollection was that the university said, we have our own system, just like they have their own system of appropriation. We just have one line item for the whole university system, and they have their own retirement system. This just happened to be another leg on the animal.
And so your summer project is to research how all 47 exemptions got there and why.
48 okay. If this passes.
There you go. Okay, thank you, Mr.
Thank
Duncan.
You
I appreciate
much.
It very much. Okay, Barry Jackson.
I'm here.
Okay, did you want to just wrap up your testimony?
Yes, I'll try to do that.
Cut you off in the middle of it before, so.
Right. I'm going to have to try to be a lot more concise than I was planning on here. With regard to the subject of how many positions are currently doing procurement-related work, I briefly spoke with Division of General Services and did a little research with them, and the number is somewhere above 200 positions. Those are now spread among the departments. The fact that those 200 positions are spread among the departments is a result of a decentralization activity that's occurred basically since I first came to work for the state in 69. So there are now some 200 to 300 positions spread in the departments, and there are roughly 6 positions in the Department of Administration Division of General Services. Procurement in the state of Alaska is now strongly decentralized, probably more strongly decentralized than any other state. So why does that matter? In a decentralized procurement activity, there are 3 concepts that are basically diminished: fairness, savings, and expertise. Operational pressures, personal preferences, and differing operational standards reduce the diligence with which the rules of fairness are applied. The inability to recognize and consolidate repetitive purchases of goods and services diminishes significant opportunities to save money. And similar procurement problems are resolved differently from department to department. In a centralized environment, the rules of fairness are better enforced, consolidation opportunities are recognized and more dependable, cost savings as a result are more dependable, and subject matter expertise is fostered and developed. Best practices can be identified, resulting in more satisfactory transactions between the state and its suppliers. The current pilot program offers an opportunity to realize the benefits of an appropriate degree of centralized procurement without the usual disadvantages. In a mature application of ASCII's e-commerce tools, the user virtually eliminates paper pushing from the procurement process. The tools allow instantaneous orders for commodities and services found in the customized catalog. The user gets instant feedback, instant accountability with regard to receipt of goods, red tape is cut, and it provides for quicker delivery. All of these things add up to the potential for increased savings. It also means that through the e-commerce tools that there is an ability to analyze procurements across departmental lines to identify consolidation opportunities and target them for additional savings. Subject matter experts are developed in a centralized procurement setting, which allow us to address procurement issues across departmental lines. In competitive scenarios, e-commerce procurement processes can give access to all qualified interested bidders and virtually eliminate the burdensome waiting periods that now characterize the manual process. Regarding the subject of the potential for corruption, I'd simply like to point out that currently the departments can spend up to $50,000 at a crack without meeting formal bidding requirements. It's my belief right now, under the current laws and regulations, that somewhere between 50% and 80% of all procurement dollars can be spent by the departments without being required to follow the formal bidding procedures encapsulated in the procurement code. I haven't seen any recent analysis of how much the state spends through procurement procedures, but if it's anything like the past, that 50% to 80% amounts to hundreds of millions of dollars per year. The point is that this money is spent with little or no competition. The reality is there's not much difference between professionally administered public and private purchasing practices, except for mountains of red tape, institutionalized delay, antiquated systems, and huge performance and efficiency gaps. Routine monitoring by General Services for procurement code violations in the operating departments is non-existent, and violations are only investigated when some form of bad conduct is alleged by an interested party or someone in the department stumbles upon a problem and reports it to General Services. I suggest that an independent contractor with preservation of its investment as its most potent motivation has an unbiased primary interest in simply doing the job as efficiently and economically as possible for the state. In fact, I would argue that an independent contractor is in a stronger position to resist pressures to commit bad practices. Such pressures do exist and are difficult for state employees to resist because their jobs or careers can be put in jeopardy. These pressures and consequences are not idle speculation on my part. They are real. I know from long and challenging personal experience. I argue that coupled with independent oversight, such as this contract has with the Division of General Services, an independent contractor with its own enlightened self-interest at heart is in a far better position to rebuff pressures to use bad practices than our rank and file state employees. In the area of these audits, I will simply say I've never before seen the level of scrutiny being applied to this contract, and that's more than 30 years of state history in the procurement field with the state's central procurement agency. If you'll bear with me a minute, I want to try to catch up on my notes here. I will state categorically that if I were given the same time and resources to audit departmental procurement activities on a quarterly basis as has been done under ASCII's contract, I would find numerous purchasing violations and bad practices, enough to startle the members of this committee. As a former senior manager of the state's procurement system, I can honestly say that the tools Alaska supply chain integrators are providing are well-tailored to the job and fit for purpose. They will create efficiencies which will increase the productivity of the users. They are the best tools I've ever seen for bringing e-commerce to Alaska state government. The union position has one main argument and one goal. I feel the argument is defective and the goal is historically unattainable. First is the argument, at least as espoused earlier in earlier testimony last week, was that the union could do the same thing as the contractor if they were just given the tools and they'd do it cheaper. If the union believes in fair play, as they've espoused in their testimony about preserving protections of the procurement code, then no one is going to give the union the necessary e-commerce tools free of charge and yet require their competitors to build their own tools at their own expense. If the unions want to compete to provide e-commerce tools and services, they better fire up their venture capitalists and create the capacity to develop software technology and service systems to get the job done. And they better have started a few years ago because the need is in front of us today. If we were to speculate, and were it possible to turn back the clock and provide for the unions to act as a joint venture proposer in the pilot project RFP, is it the union's position that they could have won the RFP as a straight-up competitor to the other proposers and preserved every one of those jobs that were lost. The only way the RFP services could possibly be performed at a lower cost than the states is to save costs by employing technological solutions that allow fewer employees to accomplish the work. This is because the source of funding for the contract is the staffing budget for the procurement function of the Southeast region of DOT. To put it bluntly, unions would need to have an e-commerce system at least the equal of Alaska supply chain integrators, and they would have to cut even more jobs if they wanted to win by being a competitor. For the unions to deliver similar results, you have to accept the notion that they would deploy technology effectively and then deliver the staff reductions made possible. I would submit to you that this is unlikely. Therefore, the only likely outcome is more cost for technology, but no savings delivered. We can see an example of this in the state's current use with procurement technology, the BuySpeed program. DOT implemented this several years ago, but it is implemented poorly and serves only to require re-input of paper records and absorb tens of thousands annually in licensing costs. The number of people who are capable of using it fully can probably be counted on the fingers of one hand. Second is the union's goal of preserving every job regardless of the march of practice, of progress. This battle has been lost over and over by unions all over the world. The goal can't be reached in the long run. In industry, including the industry of government, technological progress usually reduces or transforms staffing requirements. Instead, enlightened unions have found another perspective, one which is ultimately much more valuable to union members. That perspective is not to oppose the adoption and advancement of technology, but to bargain for ways to retrain, re-educate, and re-equip their members to compete anew in the working world, whether with the same employer or a new one. Attempting to block the march of progress because it might cost jobs of members is a classic union tactic which hasn't worked in the past 100 years and won't work here now. I would like to remind the committee that I say this as a former president of Alaska Public Employees Association and a founding member of the group that created the Alaska State Employees Association. Regardless of who implements it, including the union itself, e-commerce technology will result in staff reductions, or at least it will if it successfully delivers efficiencies. Helping those who will be affected to prepare for and find other desirable employment is the correct role for the unions to pursue.
Okay, Barry, can you wrap up here?
Yes.
I appreciate your very, very valuable testimony, and I would love to have a written copy. The fax here is 465-6592.
Okay. To wrap it up, this bill presents one of those rare opportunities to look into the future and know what to do to make things better. Taking the step of passing this legislation now will allow the state to avoid an unnecessary expenditure of public funds and at the same time save significant amounts of money, increase efficiency, and incrementally extend the use of e-commerce tools throughout state government over the next few years. I believe the introduction into state procurement of e-commerce tools and services, specifically the tools and services created and provided by Alaska supply chain integrators, is an unalloyed good. The technology is available now, the capacity to implement it is present, the cost reduction is real. All that is needed is the resolve to do the obvious. Thank you for this opportunity to be heard.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. For the other folks there, you're sort of, it's not fair to you, but what's happened is we've reached the end of our time and we've got another bill here. So I'm just going to ask if you could try to think of places where your testimony differs from testimony that others have already offered, and to consider the idea that you could submit written testimony as well. So next is Laura Lawrence.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I will try to keep this short as there are numerous people here to speak. My name is Laura Lawrence. I've been employed by the State of Alaska Department of Transportation for 24 years. During 21 of these years, I've worked in procurement for DOT. I'm speaking in opposition to House Bill 257 as well as Senate Bill 160. Not only as an employee for the state of Alaska, but as a concerned citizen. When I was first hired in procurement, I signed numerous agreements.
Can you speak up a little bit, Laura, please?
When I was first hired in procurement, I signed numerous agreements. These agreements covered all the rules and regulations dictated by the state to control purchasing ethics. If I was found in violation of these agreements, I could be guilty of a Class C felony and subject to prosecution under Alaska Statute 3630-930. These regulations and statutes dictated the state's desire to discontinue abuses of the purchasing system. I have taken my job very seriously over my tenure with the state of Alaska and have gained an excellent reputation for integrity with local businesses, out-of-state businesses, and fellow employees. These policies, codes, and statutes were put in place to stop the unorthodox purchasing that was taking place and to bring faith to the people of the state. The privately owned company that currently operates a pilot program has readily admitted to doing business with one of their own companies for supplies, yet they admit that this was a mistake. How many mistakes can we take since they don't have to follow the above rules and regulations, as do the employees of the state? How much business and money will be diverted to only particular groups or their favorite vendors? This is a disservice to the entire state's business community, as well as our local taxpayers. I am a local taxpayer as well. As an aside, I assume numerous of you members of this committee have various business backgrounds. If this is the case, you will readily relate to the following scenario. Here you are a small to average business operating exclusively in the state of Alaska. You have frequently competitively bid on various state requirements and have occasionally been fortunate to have won a bid or two. Then, instead, a national corporation, exempt from the in-state procurement rules set by the state legislator, buys against you. You now find yourself having to bid against international companies, wanting the same business and not having to follow the same state rules. It is, of course, obvious that this is like taking on Muhammad Ali with your hands tied behind your back. How could one expect a local company to follow the state rules and become low bidder while the pilot program company is exempt from the same rules? I have many Alaska vendors who look forward to yearly bids for commodities with a cost over $5,000. I have yearly inquiries as to when bids are due to come out. Vendors want to hear from me. If the state would allow and provide the state's purchasing departments the infrastructure to purchase statewide requirements electronically in the international marketplace, do you assume ASCII would come up with a lower or better cost savings? I think not. Are you aware that DOT currently has an electronic system in place and has been prevented from fully utilizing it? Untie our hands, and we can provide all the supplies and services at a rate equal or better than the outsourced company, while keeping the jobs and tax base within the state. I feel the state set the rules on using in-state vendors to help stimulate local economies and ensure local employment. This ends up being more effective. The money returns to the local economies and the state of Alaska instead of out-of-state stockholders. We have a fiduciary responsibility to the people of the state. These bills appear to be moving entirely too fast in regard to outsourcing procurement. The pilot program with ASCII is undergoing only 9 months of a trial period. That's not long enough for a thorough audit to take place. Time will only determine the success of such a pilot as suggested in the original bill. Purchasing for the Department of Transportation in itself is a vast undertaking, given the logistics, needs, and local services that are required to fulfill many of the demands needed to operate our highways and airports safely. I'm confident that an outsourced company will not be able to take on these responsibilities in a fair manner that will be just to our local companies, nor will they be aware of the local logistical problems that are innate to the individual areas. Furthermore, ASCII is using State of Alaska office space, office equipment, and a warehouse to operate their purchasing automation. Are these costs being taken into consideration when audits are being taken? Their lack of infrastructure allows or shows in itself that they are not in a position to take on such a vast responsibility. They were not prepared to handle two more entities. How can we expect them to handle the entire State of Alaska procurement function? With that said, thank you for letting me speak.
Thank you, Ms. Lawrence. I appreciate your testimony. Okay, and what I'm going to do, I'm just going to set this timer for 3 minutes. I realize it might be unfair, but I don't have a choice at this point. I've got to get moving. And as I said, I can hear some of you are preparing on both sides. It doesn't matter. You have prepared written testimony. Please, if you have that, offer to fax that to us and let us do that instead. We read through it. We've got a hefty packet here, and we can read them. So, Gail Kozlowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Gail Kozlowski. And as an Alaskan working for an Alaskan-owned business supply and office supply company, I work with the Department of Public Safety, the Department of Administration, and the Department of Natural Resources. I see a lot of competitive bidding and employees trying to manage their state funds appropriately. Our customers can go to our website or our competitor's website, look right at their contract pricing. The supplies can be delivered in a 24-hour turnaround without any paperwork, if they so choose, or they can get a hard copy. But this is e-commerce at its best. The state employees have the option to use their state contract or go to bid. They've done this effectively without going through a third party. How many of you have campaigned on increasing jobs in Alaska? I agree with Mr. Runberg about losing jobs locally. Who has the best interest of state funds at heart? Employees who are paid by the state or a non-state employee who has no vested interest? Our Alaskan prisons are making furniture for state offices. It may not be the cheapest to purchase, or it may be. I don't know the pricing on that. But the point is, we are utilizing our prison inmates in teaching them a viable job skill to help make them a more productive member of society when they finish their term in prison. Do we want to eliminate this type of job skill and training as well? Thank you for letting me share my thoughts.
Thank you, Ms. Kozlowski. Ellen Kubiak?
Yes, my name is Ellen Kubiak, and I have been a resident of Alaska for the past 30 years, and I love and am proud to be an Alaskan. And I can't believe that we are even thinking about outsourcing purchasing. I have worked for an Alaska-owned and operated company, and we're keeping our heads above the water, trying to keep the business from the big box stores, and have taken and have done very well for ourselves and for the state. I currently saved the state $600 when DOT had asked for bids for just basic supplies. I came from the local, small, owned and operated company and saved the state $600. I think that's substantial.
Ellen, are you aware that in the current bill it would require whomever does it, whether it's private, public, or private-public partnership, to conform to the bidding preferences for made in Alaska and Alaskan-owned companies?
Well, I want to be sure of that, and that's why I'm here today.
I'd be happy to fax you a copy of the bill if you want to see it.
I have a copy of the bill.
Okay.
I just wanted to come here and support the professionals that I work with every day that are procurement officers for the state of Alaska who I've gotten to know and respect, and they're doing a great job, and I really, really resent the thought of them losing their jobs. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Donna Sheelan?
Sheelan, thank you very much, Madam Chair.
My apologies on the name.
Oh, no problem. I will fax you some information, and I have another gentleman. I think he has a lot more to say than I do, and it's been
very interesting,
so I'll put something together and get it faxed down to you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Okay, and wrap up, Ken Brown.
This is Ken Brown. I'm a 30-year state employee, 20 years of it in construction procurement. I've been wrapped around the axle on this issue for about 2 years. I think they've made it pretty clear we're starting out with the result here and working backwards. The result is, if this goes forward, you're going to lay off probably 200 state employees. To me, that's not the way you run a pilot project. I mean, we're supposed to be proving up on the basis of e-procurement, but when we did the union response to ASCII's proposal, it came down to comparing salaries versus the contract amount. Outsourcing is not something to treat with callous indifference. The whole basis of outsourcing state functions is a Supreme Court case in Moore versus Department of Transportation. The concern was that when you privatize, it can be used as a means of subverting state policies relating to worker qualifications, conditions of employment, and employment benefits. It's even been stated in some of the testimony that, of course, they can save money because they don't have to provide the state retirement. Privatization violates public policy by allowing the state to avoid costs of employment it would otherwise normally bear. And the reason that those benefits exist is to assure that public employees, especially in the area of procurement, are above the fray. They can't be easily manipulated. You take an oath of office. You're working primarily for the people of the state of Alaska, for the common good and benefit of all Alaskans. This is the difference that distinguishes public service from routine commercial pursuits. And in this Moore versus Alaska Department of Transportation, the one thing that they in this case supported the legitimacy of outsourcing, but it rests on protections under the law. And it says, Keith's phrase says, to the extent that privatization creates a risk of exposing state workers to political influence, that risk is largely obviated by provisions of the State Personnel Act and state personnel rules dealing with layoffs, and by provisions of the state procurement code and the rules promulgated thereunder dealing with state contracts. Well, this bill throws out the procurement code, and it's there for a reason. I mean, there's key areas that it throws out. In other chapters of the law, it defer to this procurement code. Any claims presented against the state have to be resolved under 3630, sections 560 to 699. The procurement code, by reference, adopts the commercial code. It provides for criminal penalties for misrepresentation. It does all sorts of reporting of anti-competitive practices. I don't see where we have to go that far. I mean, the state of Oregon has instituted, a Buy Smart e-commerce, and they've done it within state government. They hired firms like ASCII to help them set it up. But back to, we're talking about outsourcing people's jobs, and like myself, you know, you're going to fight when you have a job, and there are protections. There are protections in our union contracts and in the state personnel rules, and you have to do a counter-proposal. Well, it was kind of rigged against us. The counter-proposal, we weren't allowed to. For instance, the procurement limit that Barry talked about of $50,000, where you don't have to be competitive. Well, under their contract, that's raised to $150,000. Well, if you raise it to $150,000, I could get a lot of contracts out too, get cheaply, because I could just make a couple phone calls. So they're ready to take advantage of it, but that advantage wasn't given to state employees to, you know, say, well, how could we do it if we were allowed that kind of exemption.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. I appreciate your testimony.
So we can look forward to that. I mean, I fully expect if this goes through, the Department Administration will recentralize and consolidate 200 jobs, and they'll go out with one request for proposals to outsource 200 jobs, or maybe they will break it up into several areas. But
I appreciate
that all costs
your testimony.
Money too, and that money was not allowed to be included as a cost of the outsourcing. The RFP process, the feasibility studies, in our department alone, took $100,000 straight off of our budget. I was going to use that to implement some ways of doing electronic plans for DOT to speed up our review processes, and that was gone. I didn't have the money to buy Adobe Acrobat for every draftsman.
Mr. Brown,
many hours of engineers and managers.
Can he not hear me?
Producing all the information needed for the
okay, I don't know what else to
consultant.
Do.
And as far as BioAlaska, Commissioner Miller's response to.
I'm sorry. Mr. Brown, if you can he hear me? Okay. Okay. My apologies. We have one final person. I've got to get to John Coghill's bill. Larry Howell. Larry, are you there? And Larry, I really need you. I've got a timer here. So when you hear it, it's 3 minutes. He did? Okay, perfect. All right, public testimony on this bill is closed.
Chair?
Representative Gruenberg.
If they can't hear you, they can't hear your timer either.
Probably not. That's probably true. We'll have to, you know what we'll start doing? Can teleconferencing submit those time requirements to the LIO so that they know? Okay, that's what we'll start doing. Okay, thank you very much. So we're going to set House Bill 257 to the side. We have Reneva Moss here, who's been waiting patiently to testify on House Bill number 133.
Doesn't eliminate a single job. Or outsource anything.
Okay.
Okay.
And Representative Coghill's back, too.
No, I understand that.
I didn't time that very good, did I?
You did it very well, actually. We literally just started.
Do you want me to start?
Okay, so tell us about the now famous House Bill 133.
This is an unusually directed bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Reneva Moss, legislative aide for Representative Coghill. Just to give you a background, how it started off, originally did one thing, and that was to say that any regulations that are adopted by the local boundary commission have to be consistent with state statute. And this came about when we found a regulation that allowed for an aggregate vote to be used to annex land into a borough. And state law says that in order to annex land into a borough, there has to be an election of the voters of the area to be annexed, and it has to pass by a majority vote. The aggregate vote would allow for the people living in the area to be annexed and the people who live in the existing area to vote on it, combine the votes together, and if by a combined majority vote it was approved, then the area would be annexed. This bill now says that the area to be annexed has to approve it by a majority vote, and the area of the existing municipality has to approve it by a majority vote. And the reason for that is to eliminate the possibility of a hostile takeover of an existing municipality by an annexed area. Also, Representative Harris asked that we add some concerns of his to the bill. So Section 1 is one area that Representative Harris wanted included, and it says that the local boundary commission may not amend a petition or impose conditions on the incorporation. And this definitely is a change in statutory language, but the Constitution clearly says that the Local Boundary Commission will do this as prescribed by law, and that being statutory law passed by the legislature. Section 2, under constitutional authority, the Local Boundary Commission can take a proposal to the legislature for their approval, and this would not require a vote of the people. Section 2 says that there needs to be at least two public hearings, and there should be a vote of the people. I talked to Tam Cook and asked her to analyze this bill section by section as to the constitutionality of it. She thinks Section 2, the requirement of an election, probably would not survive a constitutional challenge. I know that Representative Gruenberg has an amendment here that has severability language. I would leave it up to the committee as to what they would like to do, but we did prepare an amendment that would take out the election provision so that it would withstand a constitutional challenge. So,
do you want to pass that out?
Sure.
The severability? We already have it.
No, this... Okay, there are two, if I may. I had asked to have this bill referred to this committee when it was in State Affairs just for this limited purpose. The only question that I thought we should deal with here was the constitutional issue, and I appreciated the sponsor and Ms. Moss working with me on that. And this comes down to the question of Tam thinks that, as Ms. Moss said, Ms. Cook thinks that it's likely not to withstand a constitutional challenge. And when I talked with Ms. Cook, she said she would be willing to testify by telephone if we wished. I don't know if the chair wishes to have her. She'd be the only relevant witness on the issue. But I think we can either just delete the language, page 2, line 5, after the word incorporation.
Sir. Representative Coghill.
For myself, I think I'd rather go through the process of deleting the language than the severability, only because of the cost of trying to defend it when it's in question. I appreciate the severability issue, but I don't want the rest of the bill to get put in a place where a court can put the whole thing under a cloud when all I wanted was a simple little fix. And so I figure the counsel that we have from Tam Cook probably is very solid. And we're testing, under this bill, we're testing the legislative authority against the Boundary Commission authority, and I'm asserting rather strongly legislative authority here. However, there is some real constitutional reasons for the Boundary Commission, and when we go back and we've studied it in the different committees that we've been in, I would be satisfied in taking this portion out because it still then allows two public hearings in a community, which to me, what it does is it kicks a door open for more public process, and then the vote wouldn't be required. And so I think, just for my preference.
Madam Chair, I think that's great. Then I would not offer my amendment. And from my conversation with Ms. Cook, I'm quite sure that that would eliminate the constitutional issue. I don't see any serious problem with requiring the commission to hold two public hearings. Now, I suppose somebody could technically say that's a problem. I doubt seriously anybody would ever challenge that. And I certainly think that we ought to go with Representative Coghill's suggestion, and then we can move the bill out and be on our way.
And Madam Chair, the Boundary Commission was amenable to the two hearings.
Good.
But this portion here became problematic.
I hope you offer your amendment.
And Madam Chair, just to put on record, former Lieutenant Governor Jack Coghill testified during the State Affairs Committee hearing, and he was asked specifically about Section 1, and he said that in his estimation, what this bill did was put into statute what the intent was of the Constitutional Convention. And I think those are some very strong words that support Representative Coghill's desire for the legislature to make sure that the local boundary commission is not stepping without out of their bounds.
Representative
Madam Chair, my amendment just simply calls the attention of everybody to a statute, to the general severability statute, really doesn't add anything. And I don't know whether Section 1 is constitutional or not, but let's just take the Coghill Amendment, then we can pass the bill out.
Okay, and Sarah Felix, did you want to testify?
I'm just here to answer questions.
Thank you.
But let me, may I ask you?
Yeah, we do have a question for you.
I am going to...
is this for Ms. Felix or for...
For Ms. Felix, yeah.
Thanks for your patience sitting through the procurement bill, too.
Very interesting.
If I may, my question goes to Section 1 of the bill. Since you're the person that might be called on to defend this, Section 1 of the bill, do you see a problem with the department defending Section 1 of the bill?
Madam Chair, Representative Gruenberg, I am really not the person. Let me just first state, I'm Sarah Felix from the Attorney General's office, and I'm here for Margie Vandoor of our office, and she is the Assistant Attorney General who is assigned to do local boundary commission work. So I was able to have a discussion with Ms. Vandoor before she had to leave town, and she will be back tomorrow if the committee wants to hear from her. But she did express to me that in this bill, her concern is with Section 1. And I've sort of prepared a little outline of what she expressed her concerns as, and I'll give them to the committee now. She indicated that the Local Boundary Commission is one of the few constitutionally created commissions, and that the framers expressed an intent that boundary decisions be made at a statewide rather than a local level because of the statewide interests in municipal organization of Alaska. Case law interpreting the Local Boundary Commission authority has found that the commission has discretion to alter boundaries presented in incorporation petitions, and that's the Yakutat case. Case law has also recognized the Local Boundary Commission's constitutionally based authority. That's the Yakutat and the Mobile Oil cases. However, we know that that not every issue has been decided. I mean, there has been some litigation concerning the authority of the Local Boundary Commission, but there are still a lot of unanswered questions. The line dividing the Local Boundary Commission's constitutional authority and the legislature's authority to enact laws restricting the Local Boundary Commission's authority is not entirely clear. Existing precedent suggests that removing the Local Boundary Commission's authority to change boundaries in incorporation petitions raises a constitutional issue. So Ms. Vandoor wanted me to stress that her reading of the Constitutional Convention debate indicates that the framers intended that the concept behind adopting the constitutional provision authorizing the Boundary Commission was that political decisions don't usually create proper boundaries, and that boundaries should be established at the state level, and that the advantage of the method proposed in the Constitution for the Local Boundary Commission lies in placing the process at a level where area-wide or statewide needs can be taken into account, and that by placing that authority in this third party, the Commission, the arguments for and against boundary changes can be analyzed objectively. So, sorry to be secondhand. I'm sorry I'm not the real person, but we did want to raise that issue for your consideration about Section 1 of the bill.
Thank you very much.
Sure. To address that, the committee needs to understand that the case law, is based on a state statute that we are now changing. So that really doesn't apply. And the Constitution says that the board may consider any proposed local government boundary changes. It doesn't say that they can amend it or alter it in any way. It just says that they may consider it. So I think the legislature definitely, under the Constitution, has the authority to change the statute and direct the local boundary commission. If you look under Article 12, Section 11, it does say that law and legislature is interchangeable. So prescribed by law doesn't mean the Constitution. It doesn't mean local boundary commission regulations. It means statutes that are passed by the legislature.
Okay, we have Commissioner Blatchford here to testify. Thank you, Ms. Felix.
Thank you.
Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Edgar Blatchford. I'm Commissioner for the Alaska Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, and I believe I have Director Mike Black online. But first, Madam Chair and members of the committee, let me apologize to the Majority Leader for not advising him of the concerns the department has, but it was only this morning that we decided to take a stand on this bill, and or to at least let you know where we stand on sections of the bill. Our concerns, Madam Chair.
Is that an apology?
No, you don't have to.
I didn't have any idea about this. Go ahead.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, as it is, the department looks at this bill from an advocacy agency point of view. As all of you are aware, the department has this obligation to be the advocate for the unorganized borough and to promote municipalities, whether they're cities or boroughs. And our concerns are that it reverses the local boundary commission's authority to amend and impose conditions on the petition. We're concerned that the voters must first approve this annexation or detachment before the legislature can take action. We are also concerned that proposals for legislative review must first be approved by residents of the area. And we're concerned also that the annexation into existing boroughs and cities would be almost impossible or probably improbable without support from the annexed areas. As it is, then it's unlikely that there would be any more organized governments in the unorganized borough. And the unorganized borough, we believe, can remain confident that until they decide to incorporate, an existing borough or city would not be able to attach them to their boundaries. And looking at the bill as it is, Madam Chair, members of the committee, we believe that this could impede development of natural resources. We believe too that as the bill is, as it stands now, that it would hinder the assumption of local responsibilities by local people, and we also believe, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that the bill could prevent local people from seizing the opportunities that come with local government. You know, those, Madam Chair, are our concerns. And Madam Chair, I must also state that we have not seen any of the proposed language that would be considered that has been discussed so far.
Other. Representative Coggill, you want to respond?
I'm surprised. So, however, we will take at probably one area that I'm going to put in for an amendment that will be Section 2, lines 5 through 9, if the committee agrees to my proposal. And I appreciate that the department is concerned, as I am. I think we need to organize in Alaska. We need to organize in boroughs. But the Constitution has allowed for unorganized and organized boroughs. It also said that as we begin to populate and become an economy, that we are to be considered organization along several different criteria. We set up a boundary commission to help us figure those things out. But at the end of the day, it's going to be based on the law that we put together that respects the right of the individual voter. and it's our job to protect that. It's the administration's job to administer it. So I can recognize their reluctance, because they're going to advocate for a particular style that they've been doing. So I have no problem. But remember, they're going to bring their proposals to us, and here's the action that we have, probably one of the few times in constitutional law you're going to see this, that the only action that the legislature can do is disapprove something. That's a huge negative vote. Almost everything else we do in the legislature is affirmative, with the exception of this one issue. So it gives the local boundary commission a huge authority. And so the authority then has to be carefully crafted by law. And so I understand that they're concerned about, but one of the things we have as raising our hands part of constitutional duty is to make sure that the individual voters in those areas are not forced into a government that they don't want. So there's that balance. It's no doubt about it. We've set it up where we want a larger agency looking at the need to organize. But it's not just about whether we should have the Pogo mine in there or the pipeline in there, but what are the transportation structures? What are the economic structures? What are the social structures? And so as we look at them, that's our job. And part of our job then is to say, folks, we're going to give you a right to have a say in that matter.
May I make a suggestion? Okay, let's take the Cog Hill Amendment as amendment number one and dispose of that. Then I have a way of maybe solving the problem. This other thing, but let's deal with one first.
Let me thank you, Mr. Commissioner. Let me just get to these final folks here for public testimony.
That was my very impassioned response, but
I actually only have a couple folks here. I have Debbie Johnson.
Yes, I'm marginal. This call.
I can't hear you, Ms. Johnson.
Is that any better there?
Yes.
Oh, good. Sorry, I'm on a cell phone and it's real marginal reception. I just wanted to say I'm a concerned resident of a subdivision in Union Bay, right by Myers Chuck, and I firmly believe that the best way to reflect the desires of the community is to be able to let the people vote on whatever's going to be happening within that community. I think that's the most proper way to reflect the desires of the people of a community instead of just bypassing and going to the legislature.
Okay, thank you for your testimony, Ms. Johnson.
Okay, thank you very much.
Catherine Peavy? Ms. Peavy, are you there? She's still on or off? Okay, she's off. George Guckert? And then we're almost done. George Guckert? Okay, he's no longer online. We're moving quickly. Let's see here. Mike Black was just answering questions. Debbie Thompson. I bet it was Debbie Johnson and somebody wrote it funny. Yeah. That's a repeat. Okay, anybody else in the audience that wishes to testify on House Bill 133? Say it again. For House Bill 133? What's the name?
I'm here.
Okay. Go ahead. Just state your name if you can, and then we'll wrap up with public testimony. 3 minutes.
Are you talking to me?
Yes, I am.
Oh, my name is Dr. Vi Gerald, PhD, and I'm also for Doris Kamana and Alaskans of Post-Annexation. We support HB 133, sponsor statement by Representative John Coghill, regarding powers of the local boundary commission. Regarding any attachments or annexations, we want a vote of the people only in the area that a city or another group is trying to annex. We do not want a combined vote. We do not want an aggregate vote. Now, let me read you one comment from a transcript very briefly. This is State of Alaska Local Boundary Commission agenda meeting of January 5th, 2:05, 9 a.m. in Anchorage, telephonic. Okay, on the agenda is 8, decisional session, City of Homer annexation remand.
Okay. Doris Kaman and I hired attorney Robert Irwin, former Alaska Supreme Court Justice, to oppose annexation by City of Homer. We fought it. We're still fighting it since Superior Court in Anchorage. And they did not get the 26 square miles they wanted, LBC. They took 4.58. Now, this is one I want to read to you. On this agenda,
let's ask Sarah what she thinks.
Let me tell you. this is the official agenda, okay? And these are the official minutes. This is Commissioner Robert Harcharek speaking. And these are not my words, they're his. Okay, part of it is by Commissioner Robert Harcharek. He's commenting. I strongly believe that the judicial system was totally out of line in remanding us to rehear this action. What I should tell you is a Superior Court judge in Anchorage remanded the Homer annexation case back to a local boundary commission to consider the effect that the Homer annexation of 4.58 square miles had on Ketchikan Emergency Service Area of 214 miles, which we formed. Here, so this is just a few brief lines here. Harcharek, I strongly believe that the judicial system was totally out of line in remanding us to rehear this action. It is not in the administrative code. It's not a part of our legislative procedures and so forth. And I'll jump to this. I feel that if we're going to send a message, it's to tell the judges to stay the hell out of it because it has nothing for them to do with it. Now, that's absolutely, in my view, illegal. It's inappropriate. That's showing how out of line, in my view, how illegal the local boundary commission members are acting. They have to follow. I'll tell you what former Attorney Justice, Supreme Court Justice Robert Irwin said. He read the decisional statement by LBC regarding the annexation of the City of Homer, and he said the local boundary commission cannot call the judges' names, in effect. That's what he said.
Okay.
He said they have to go by the rule of the court. They have to follow the order of the court, and this boundary commission is not doing it. They need to be replaced totally, and the director, Mike Black, in my view, and Dan Bockhorst, staff commissioner who gives summaries, inaccurate summaries, misrepresentation to the local boundary commission, needs to be replaced. We are the people.
What's going on?
He could mute them.
Okay. Ma'am, we're going to ask you to wrap up. My apologies. I need you to wrap up. The timer just went off.
Well, a couple constitutional things. Public money cannot be used to deny people due process of law. The United States Constitution is the supreme law of the land, and everyone has to go by it, including the judges. The local boundary commission has to go by it. They have to be replaced. All five of them. And the two.
Okay, ma'am, now you're really off topic.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Okay, public testimony on House Bill 133 is closed. That brings the bill back before us.
Ma'am?
We have two amendments. Can you turn them off, please? Okay, brings the bill back before us. Conceptual Amendment Number 1 by Representative Coghill. This is page 2, line 5. This is the amendment we've been discussing.
Yes, Madam Chair, I move Amendment Number 1.
Okay.
After the word incorporation, delete all the language through line 9 except the period, which takes out the section that talks about after 30 days notification, Director of Elections shall order an election, et cetera, et cetera. So takes the election out of it, but leaves the public comment hearing in it.
So moved. Okay. Any objection to that motion? Okay. Hearing none, Amendment Number 1 carries. Further amendments? Representative Gruenberg, do you think your severability is necessary? No, I don't either. Okay, any further amendments to the bill? Okay, hearing none, do I hear a motion?
So moved.
Okay, so moved by Representative Gruenberg. House Bill 133 as amended, individual recommendations and zero fiscal notes. Any objection? 1-0 fiscal note. Any objection to that motion? Okay, hearing none, House Bill 133 as amended has moved. We're going to recess to the call of the chair.
All right, sir.
Yes.
Oh, we just said a little constitution.